good to be with you again, and thank you to Frank for opening us and praying the Lord's blessing on our time together. What I want us to do this morning is to continue what we began to do last Sunday morning, which is to investigate this notion of God's incomprehensibility. We were taking as a sort of pretext or motive for our study that threefold affirmation of incomprehensibility that we find in the first half of section 1, chapter 2 of our confession, page 671 in the back of the hymnal, of God and of the Holy Trinity. Let me reread again that first half of Article 1 there, noticing the three places where we see this, and then we'll come back to our biblical consideration of this doctrine of incomprehensibility, and then say a few things maybe about exactly what does this involve with regard to how we talk about God. The confession begins this way, chapter 2, paragraph 1. The Lord our God is but one living and true God, whose subsistence is in and of himself, being infinite in being and perfection. And then here's our first affirmation of incomprehensibility. Whose essence cannot be comprehended by any but himself. So it's a doctrine of incomprehensibility as respects man, and it's a doctrine of divine comprehensibility as respects God. Okay, going on. A most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, who only hath immortality, and then here's the second affirmation of incomprehensibility, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto. Okay, 1 Timothy 6. Going on, who is immutable, immense, an old word for omnipresent, eternal, and then again, incomprehensible, almighty, every way infinite, most holy, most wise, most free, most absolute. So we see this, of all the things here, the absoluteness, the self-sufficiency of God is emphasized, but three times in slightly different ways, this same truth of God's incomprehensibility is conveyed to us. This means that a good bit of our theologizing, a good bit of our talk about God, is going to proceed in what we might call a negative mode. The medievals would have called this the via negativa, the way of negation. So sometimes we're left saying often what God is not rather than what he is. Stephen Charnock's words again are helpful. Though we cannot comprehend him as he is, we must be careful not to fancy him to be what he is not. And sometimes saying what he isn't is as close as we come. In other words, we don't form this perfect picture, kind of perfectly symmetrical in a one-to-one way, mirroring God in our minds, because the infinite cannot be mirrored in the finite, right? The infinite cannot be contained by the finite. So we looked at a few passages, particularly in the book of Job, Zophar's words where he asked Job, can you find out the limits of the Almighty? The answer, no. The reason, there aren't any. In other words, it's not because you don't have the tools necessary to do it. It's because it's a fruitless mission to begin with. Now, you think, oh, that's Zophar, and the book of Job later condemns the counsel of Zophar, and admittedly, there is a lot of good theology badly applied in the three friends of Job. Elihu, though, as I mentioned last week, who does not come under any condemnation or any apparent disapproval in the book of Job, again, of all the major speakers in Job, only God and Elihu are presented to us without any question of fidelity or soundness in their language. Again, I think Elihu, this sort of mysterious young man who is not one of Job's three friends, we need to keep that in mind, appears in chapters 33 to 37 and I think appears as the human wisdom teacher. And then a good bit of his wisdom is, as it were, then taken up by God as God gives Job what he asked for, a hearing. Mm-hmm. But of course, God takes charge of the hearing and turns it around on Job and puts him in the dock and says, you can't put me in the dock until you answer a few questions about me. Job says, at the end of all that, in effect, I can't. To which then the question naturally arises, well, then how is it that you thought you could put God in the dock, interrogate him, and comprehend him? In other words, you assume that God was more easily comprehensible than he in fact is. In other words, this whole idea of us interrogating God, and as if I can put it this way, to grab the language of Romans 11, searching out his ways, right? His ways are beyond searching out. This idea that we could search out his ways, which is, of course, the motive to thinking that if we interrogate him, we're going to get answers that completely make sense and put everything together in our minds. The assumption that God is that way is, in fact, the first misstep. It makes that whole, the incomprehensibility of God makes that whole human judgment of God thing that we sometimes want to do, like Job wants to do, makes that a non-starter. Means that that's a foolish first step. God shows Job that through this long interrogation at the end of the book of Job. Twice, though, Elihu reminds us, and we looked at these in some depth last week, of God's incomprehensibility. Job 36:26. Behold, it's talking about the exalted works of God, that of which men sing. All men have seen it. Man beholds from afar. Behold, God is exalted. And then he says, and we do not know. That is to say, we do not know him in this exalted state. How do we know him? We know him in his condescended manifestations of power and mercy and wrath and all the different ways in which God shows himself to us through the events of history and creation. We see this and we praise him for it, but we understand that we are beholding, even as we see him in his manifested nearness, we're beholding him from afar. There's a beyondness in his transcendence that we do not know. And so Elihu says, God is exalted and we do not know him. And then very sort of idiomatically, in a kind of idiosyncratic way, he says, and the number of his years is unsearchable. And that's just a way of saying not that God is really old. Again, as if God is eternal and not measured by time, then God isn't old and God isn't young. Daniel calls him the Ancient of Days. But again, not because God is hoary-haired and a long white beard as Michelangelo conceived him, but rather he's called the Ancient of Days because in a Hebrew world, being ancient is a reason to be respected. And to call God the Ancient of Days is to say that God is the one who is to be honored above all times, okay? Above everything in the created order. So again, when Elihu says the number of his years is unsearchable, his point is not God is really old and you don't know how to count that high, okay? Like my kids, you know, Dad, what's the highest number? You know, keep going. And that's the point is not God isn't somewhere up there and you just don't have time to count up to it. The point is his years are unsearchable because there aren't really years. There isn't. He doesn't exist as that kind of thing that can be counted up by us and then eventually, you know, captured and put into a formula. There is this beyondness of exaltation. By the way, Elihu isn't saying, and isn't this all very depressing? He's saying, doesn't this all magnify his greatness and cause us in our worship to, in a certain sense, come before him with a holy silence where we would transgress and think that God was easily understood? It really does come down to our worship, and it does come down to our walk, and it does come down to the test of our faith. Will we worship a God that cannot be captured in our thoughts? You know the temptation. You know that it'd be easy to point the finger out there at all different sorts of attempts at theology. I've been reading a book this last week in which the author repeatedly reminds us that this whole doctrine of divine incomprehensibility and ineffability is just nonsense, because if God is incomprehensible and God is ineffable, the old term that we use, then we can't know him at all, and all Christian worship is therefore nullified and made worthless and meaningless, and it's just a sound of words referring to nothing. Okay. That's not how the Bible itself portrays the unknowability of God. The unknowability of God is something before which we stand in awe. Again, not because he's absolutely unknown whatsoever, not because when we say God, there's just a mystical blank in our heads, okay? But rather because when we say God, we understand that even in what we know and say about him, there is a mystery and a beyondness, and yet also there is a condescended nearness of revelation. He is showing himself through his mighty acts of judgment and of mercy and of creation and of sustenance. Okay? He is showing himself. But again, there's this unknown even in the known. If we can't find a happy place where we can sort of own both of those, if we demand it's either I don't know him at all or I know him just as well as I know other things, if we demand one of that either or, we're going to miss the mystery that Scripture invites us to as it portrays God to us, both in response to his manifestation and to his beyondness. Job 37, 22 and 23, again, Elihu speaks about the manifestation of his power and his glory. Out of the north comes golden splendor. Around God is awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him, Elihu says. Oh, well then, why worship? Why study the Scriptures? Why pray? Why take Paul seriously when he prays for the saints that they would grow in the knowledge and the grace of God? If he is surrounded by this awesome majesty in which he cannot be found, again, Paul's way of saying that in 1 Timothy 6 is he is the one who dwells in inapproachable light, then what's the point? The point is that the awesome majesty with which he cloaks himself, the awesome majesty in which he is hidden from us and which no man has seen, or we have to go bigger than that, can see, thanks Steve, it's not just that God happens not yet to have been seen in his inner intrinsic plenitude of glory, but one day, you know, there's going to be a Sir Edmund Hillary of sorts, you know, the first man to Mount Everest, to really hit, to reach the peak. One day somebody's going to get inside that shroud of glory, and they're going to find that infinite, they're going to look nakedly, as it were, on that infinite plenitude of divine being, which just is the divinity of God. And, you know, and one day we'll get there, and maybe it'll be in glory. That's, and to Steve's point, that's not what Paul doesn't say God happens yet to not have been comprehended. He's saying he dwells in inapproachable light, which no man can see or can see. In other words, it has to do not just with the fact that we happen yet not to have comprehended him. I happen yet to have not comprehended Einstein's theories of general and special relativity. Theoretically, very theoretically, if I had the time and the resources and the leisure and the industry and all the other things needed, I might be able to get it, to make sense of it. In other words, the point is not that we don't know God because we don't have the time, the leisure, the whatever other conditions are necessary to advance in knowledge. It's because of the way that God exists and the way that we exist involve a certain unviolable incommensurability. That is to say, there is always and will ever be a beyondness in God that cannot be broached or closed by the creature. We would, in effect, have to sort of graduate to divinity ourselves. That will not happen. Nor should we want it to. We're not being saved from our finitude, by the way. This growth in the knowledge of God, we're talking about God as our creator, as our merciful redeemer, but we're not trying to be saved from the fact that we don't comprehend God. We're trying to be saved from the fact that we are his hostile enemies due to sin. Salvation is not about sort of overcoming the creator-creature distinction. It's overcoming the holy God-sinner distinction. If we keep that in mind, then we'll understand that reconciliation is not about figuring God out. It's about humbling ourselves before the God who cannot be put into a figure of human speech and thought. All right. Just a quick response to this. So, in 38, God begins his diatribe against Job and interrogates Job, and again, sort of a kind of holy sarcasm, says, I'll ask you, and you instruct me, right? And the idea is, well, you presume to know so much about me. You tell me all about me, and then we'll see if you know me well enough to know that you can interrogate me. Okay? And then he asks the questions, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. And he goes on. And the text goes on like this for quite a number of chapters. In chapter 40, Job finally answers the Lord, starting in verse 3. Job answered Yahweh and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? And then here's how he replies. I lay my hand on my mouth. I thought I knew God so well that I could haul him into my courtroom and get the answers. I could search out his ways, and when I found them, I would get it. And he says, I'm not doing that anymore. That's Job's one error in this book, and that's corrected by this encounter finally with the Lord. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, I will add nothing more. I have already opened my mouth too many. The first time I opened my mouth was already one too many times. And then when I opened my mouth again, I just added to my problem. I'm not going to open my mouth a third time. All right, because that's what he's saying. Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. Said, okay, I'm done with you. Now go ahead. You had some questions for me? Go ahead. Job says, nope, I've already made that mistake more than once. I'm not going to compound it by a third time, opening my mouth, presuming to comprehend God. That's a little interlude. Then God goes on a little more for the rest of the chapter. He answers Job out of the storm. Gird up, and I'll ask you, and you instruct me. And it's the same thing he did two chapters earlier. And he kind of brings a last barrage to really cement this in Job's mind. And he goes on like this all the way through the end of chapter 41. And then in 42, Job finally does answer God. But it's the same answer he knew already halfway through the dialogue or the monologue of God that he should give, which is this. Job answered Yahweh and said, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. God had asked him earlier, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Who's this who is shrouding wisdom under ignorance? Okay, it was Job. Job. It's a rhetorical question. Job knows Job is the answer. I'm the one who hides counsel without knowledge. Therefore, he says, I have declared that which I did not understand. Declared what? That God's ways, that I could search out God's ways, and when I searched them out, he had, an obligation to reveal them to me, and I could understand. I could comprehend them if he did. God has now shown him, in a number of ways, that he does not comprehend his ways, even with regard to the things that are created, how much more with regard to anything else? And he says, I spoke what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, this is key, which I did not know. Can I suggest something? I don't think that Job is saying, oh, thanks for the added information, I didn't know that before, but now that I know it, let's get back to my question. I think what he's saying is, the things that were too wonderful for me to comprehend are not now not too wonderful for me. Do you see what I get? The whole idea of wonder there's such a splendor and a wonder of God that is beyond, all I can do is sort of look at it slack-jawed, amazement, understanding that I don't get this thing, this one who is God. He says, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. His point is, well, now they are no longer too wonderful for me because now I get it. That's not what Job is saying. If that were the case, he could take his hand off his mouth and begin again with his interrogation. But that's not what he does. Hear now and I will speak. I will ask you and you instruct me. I will listen to you. You are beyond me. You are too wonderful for me to comprehend. I retract. I repent in dust and ashes. So, in the end, Job sort of gets the lesson of incomprehensibility, which is that it's going to require an utter faith and confidence in God's goodness and in God's ways. Some will say, oh, this is blind faith. Again, this is only a leap in the dark if you don't have a good reason to trust God at all. In other words, this is only a leap in the dark if God has never revealed anything about himself. But that's not the case. All right, one other Old Testament text I want to add in addition to this. The words of David in Psalm 139. Also, and by the way, just to kind of give you an idea of where I'm going with this, I want us to get to this idea of divine incomprehensibility as not merely a doctrine which says there is more about God than we currently know about God. In other words, I think most of us can, of course it involves that. Most of us can begin there. I have not met a Christian who says, there's nothing about God I don't perfectly understand. Or I've never met a Christian who thinks that there's not something more about God they could possibly learn. I think most of us agree with that kind of baseline level of incomprehensibility, meaning, I know God, but there's more that I don't know. Okay. Maybe there's someone out there who thinks they've got a but I haven't met them. What I want to say, though, is divine incomprehensibility involves more than just that. It involves, if I could put it like this, if we were to think of it like a continuum of knowledge, on a line, let's say that there's an unending being of God who's not comprehended by creation, and let's say that your knowledge of God, I'm going to change colors here, that your knowledge of God extends only so far, okay? And so you could admit, beyond what is known, what I know about God, there's all this that is yet unknown about God. so that the unknown sort of lies here beyond your current ability, your current status of knowing God. What I'm wanting to say is divine incomprehensibility does not merely involve that which lies on the side of the unknown, but I want to suggest, and we'll see this again in just a second in David's words, I want to suggest that divine incomprehensibility also involves what you do know. In other words, if we were to put a bracket around this, we'll just put it out there. Incomprehensibility is not merely referring to the stuff beyond what you currently know so that you comprehend him to just the extent that you know him. What we want to say is that even in our knowing, we are not comprehending. Okay? Even in our knowing, we are not comprehending. And I know that this gets a little difficult for English speakers. We tend to use these words somewhat interchangeably. Do you comprehend is often for us a shorthand for do you know, and I think we can kind of trip up on this because of our customary way of speaking. Doctrinally, though, we need to be careful to keep separate this question of knowing truly and comprehending as really formally referring to two different things. So let's look at Psalm 139 briefly, and I'm only looking at the first six verses. David is talking about God's perfect knowledge of him in verses 1 through 4, and then about God's perfect, interestingly, comprehension of him, enclosing him in behind and before. And then in verse 6, he gives us a kind of pious response to the things he has just said for five verses. So a little sampling of what he says. O Yahweh, O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know when I sit down, when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there was a word in my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. Okay, so here are a number of statements, various shades of emphasis showing God's absolute perfect knowledge of him, his ways, his habits, and also the words he speaks. Again, I don't think this is God just merely predicting before you say it, oh, I knew you were going to say it, sort of like a spouse might do, you know, I knew you were going to say that because you just know them so well. I don't think it's like that. When he says, behold, before there's a word in my tongue, you know it all, because from the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. I think this is a way of saying God knows every motive and impulse of your heart that leads to the speech that you say. In other words, it's not just merely, you know, God saw a pre-release of the tape, so to speak, but rather that God knows us perfectly in our inner man. And then 5, you've enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. With all your perfect knowledge of me, good and ill, you encompass me, you hold me in, you provide for me, you take care of me. Now verse 6. Such knowledge, he says, is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Now, back to this point. What is David saying? Is he saying, I understand this much about you, but then I have a feeling there's so much more? I don't think so. I think what he is saying is, even the things that I know, verses 1 to 5, the things that I have just said, these are the knowledge of these, the knowledge that you know in this way and care for me in this way, this is what is too wonderful for me. In other words, what is too wonderful is not something else about God beyond what he knows. What is too wonderful for him and too high to attain is what he does know. In other words, you don't, if we can put it this way, you possess knowledge, but there's something in that knowledge you possess that is unattained. In other words, you know him, but there's a mystery even in what you know. So that the mystery isn't on the other side of what you know. The mystery about God is in what you know. And I think that's what David is saying here. It's too high, I cannot attain it. Does David say, I know nothing about you, you're just a big kind of mystical blank in my mind? No, that would mean the first five verses, what are they even doing there? In other words, there are clearly many things, and beyond this, many other things that he affirms about the Lord, that he knows about the Lord, but he knows that in his knowing there is a beyondness even with respect to what he knows. See what I'm getting at? It's not a beyondness of the unknown as opposed to the known. It's a beyondness even of the known. Okay? And when our confession says God is incomprehensible, it is not referring to, all the other stuff that we haven't included, that there's more stuff than we've included in the confession about him. In other words, it's not that he's comprehensible to the extent that we know the things in our confession. We're saying that he's incomprehensible even with regard to all the things we are confessing about him. That his eternity, we know it, we confess it, and we don't comprehend it. His power, we know it, we confess it, we see the demonstrations of it, and we don't comprehend it. His wisdom, we know it, we see the effects of it, we confess it, but we don't comprehend it. In other words, it's not a question of know and comprehend, or don't know and don't comprehend. It's a question of know and don't comprehend. Okay? And so the incomprehensibility, again, is not just a mere quantitative statement saying, there's quantitatively more stuff about God than I currently know. I think we would all say that. But rather that even in what I know, there is something about God that I am not perfectly sort of measuring with my mind. There are some other texts. I'm not going to read through all of them. A few in the Psalms we can quickly go to. Psalm 145:3. Says, great is Yahweh, great is the Lord, and highly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable, or maybe your translation says unfathomable. We talked about this, that, you know, when you it's this nautical term, that you when you fathom something, literally it is the idea of dropping a measuring line off the end of your ship until that weight hits the bottom, at which point you have a certain length of line, and when you haul that line in, you can measure the line, and you have fathomed the water. That is to say, you have measured the fathoms of depth. Okay? When we, as it were, drop the line of human... Now, follow this. By the way, we have used what we've done is we have just metaphorically taken a properly nautical term, fathom, and we've moved it over into the realm of epistemology. We now use it as a knowledge term, right? When I say, that's unfathomable... Okay, I'm saying I can't get my mind around that. But of course, the original sense is borrowed from a nautical terminology of measuring fathoms, which are a certain measure of depth. Okay, when we say that something's unfathomable, it could be unmeasurable or unfathomable, as the psalmist says, for two reasons. It could be unfathomable. There's a lot of syllables in there. I gotta slow it down. It could be unfathomable because your line is too short. It could be unfathomable, this is much more profound, because there is no bottom. See what I'm getting at? In other words, that is to say, there is not some limit or measure on the depth. So that if we want to say God is unfathomable, we could just mean to say, so far I have not dropped enough intellectual line on God to get to the last thing. But watch this. There is no last great thing about God. God's greatness isn't really, really, really just great and then it stops. In other words, there is no stopping point. There is no limit to the greatness of the Almighty. So that it's not just a matter of having enough line. Okay, it's a matter of what kind of being are we even talking about when we talk about knowing. If we're talking about a being whose greatness isn't just so far and no further, that is to say, a being whose greatness has a certain limit, even if a great limit, if we're talking about a being with no bottom, that is to say, there is no last great thing about God, then you can drop line unendingly, and you will never fathom his greatness because your little weight, as it were, will never strike bottom. Got it? The reason we confess God's... Oh, by the way, why is divine incomprehensibility included in an article of our confession talking about God rather than talking about, like, say, revelation or human knowledge? Because incomprehensibility is most fundamentally not a question about how much man knows. It is most fundamentally rooted in the question, what kind of being is God? In other words, it really is most properly answered in terms of, again, back to the question, is he unfathomable primarily because of our current knowledge situation, lacking enough line to get to the bottom, or is he incomprehensible because of the infinitude and plentitude of his being? And the confession puts this in the doctrine of God because it's the latter. This is really a doctrine about the being of God. The knowledge, the limitation of our knowledge is just coincident, as it were. It's entailed in that. In fact, If we were to think of God's knowledge, our confession says that God is incomprehensible to all but himself. Now, if I can use the analogy very crudely, if God drops a line on God's knowledge, does he reach the bottom? No. But does God have a finite line that he drops on an infinite being? No. Psalm 147:5. Great is our Lord and abundant in strength, and his understanding is, it literally says, innumerable. NASB translates it infinite, which is, I think, a fair translation. Innumerable, that is to say, it cannot be measured. What would be the proper object of an innumerable act of knowledge? That is to say, let's say it's an infinite act of knowledge. What would be the proper object of an infinite act of knowledge? To what could an infinite act of knowledge actually be directed? I'll work you there. I know this is a lot, and some of you miss coffee, and we're stepping into it. We'll do a little thought experiment, and then we'll get back to Psalm 147. Does the world, by the world I mean the totality of everything that exists that is not God, that is to say, everything not God, which is thereby made by God, does the world require an infinite act of knowledge to be known? No. Now, we don't know anybody who's ever known the world perfectly, but why wouldn't it, Steve?
Because it's finite.
Because it's finite. Because there is a limit to the greatness of the world. The world is great. You don't know anyone who comprehends it and knows it in all of its, no creature who comprehends it. But the point is, hypothetically, a finite knowledge could be it would be the most amazing finite knowledge you ever knew and never encountered, but hypothetically, a finite knowledge could correspond to a perfect knowledge of the world because the world itself is finite. It does not constitute an infinite object of knowledge. But here it says that God, I think sometimes we get into this, oh, God has to have infinite knowledge in order to know the world perfectly. I like to say, it helps. In other words, I can see that obviously that would be included in an infinite act of knowledge, that he would know exactly and perfectly everything that he made and sustains by his own power and from his own wisdom. So, of course, an infinite act of knowledge makes God perfectly adequate to the knowledge of everything that is to be known in the world. So I don't want to pour cold water on that notion entirely, but what I want to be careful of is not thinking that somehow only an infinite act of knowledge is adequate to know the world, because that would presuppose that the world somehow demands an infinite being in order to be known. But if the world is finite, hypothetically, a great finite knowledge could comprehend it. So, back to our text. Great is our Lord, abundant in strength. His understanding is innumerable. The proper object of this understanding cannot be... Well, I say the proper object. The world is included in this. But the proper object that actually corresponds to this act of divine knowledge is actually only one. The only thing that corresponds to an infinite act of knowledge really is an infinite act of being. That is to say, the only infinite thing to be known by an infinite act of knowing is that which is in fact infinite, which is only God, the only one who has greatness without boundary. So, our confession says, incomprehensible to all but to himself, right? So, in a kind of accommodated way, Paul says in Corinthians, the Spirit searches the deep things of God. Okay, well, does the Spirit search the deep things of God because he searches really, really, really deep until he gets to the bottom? No, the depths of the Almighty are bottomless depths. Okay, and the Spirit knows the Almighty perfectly in a bottomless infinite. In other words, the Spirit searching the deep things of God is the infinite understanding of God doing its act of infinite understanding. Okay. By the way, this is why God will always be incomprehensible to you, not simply because your line only stretches so far, but because even in all that God is, there is this kind of... In other words, let's say that you know God as wise, good, and powerful. But God's wisdom is not a finite wisdom. His power is not a finite power. His goodness is not a finite goodness. So therefore, when you know His wisdom, His power, and His goodness, you are knowing finitely that which exists in Him without boundary, which means there is always a disjunct between the manner in which you know God and the manner in which what you know actually exists in God. This is why we wonder. This is why we, and by the way, back to David's words in Psalm 139, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too high I cannot attain it. His point is not, this is frustrating. In Scripture, divine mystery always precipitates worship, not frustration. Not this kind of, we're not Sherlock Holmes, each of us trying to solve the mystery of God. I like to say this. Theological mysteries, mysteries that have to do with the divine being, are not mysteries meant for solving. They are mysteries meant for preserving and adoring. That I think our human spirit, that militates against our desire to really have a handle on everything. When we solve mysteries, we gain a measure of power. We gain a certain control over our lives and our situations as we dispel the mysteries from our lives. And so, when you solve the mysteries of, what's wrong with your car, you gain a certain power and ability to control the functioning of your car. I don't have this power. I pay someone else to have that power. But the point is, knowledge gives us control. And what we find is, and as we grow in knowledge, we grow in the ability to manage our lives in the finite world. I don't say anything is wrong. I mean, as long as we are not deluding ourselves with ideas of grandeur, I don't say that this is a wrong thing to try to gain control over your life through an increase of knowledge regarding the natural world. I'm glad somebody made that effort, because that's why we have antibiotics, and that's why we have 20-story skyscrapers, and that's why we have fuel-injected engines. And, in other words, I don't mind the idea that somebody got a certain measure of knowledge over the natural order and therefore was able to control it, harness it, direct it to the benefit of themselves or others. I think that's almost imaging God in a way. That is taking the command to subdue the world and to subdue it to the flourishing of humanity. And for that industry, we are grateful. Let us not think God is one of those items over which we need to get a certain intellectual mastery so that we can thereby manipulate, harness, move God to serve the needs and flourishing of humans. Let us not think God is like that. And I think that's what happens sometimes, is we feel like knowledge gives me control everywhere else, and if I'm going to have control over my spiritual life, I need a God that I can explain, Alpha to Omega. I can comprehend this God. All right. There are some other texts that we could look at. I'm not going to get into all of them. A few that you know. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. God's ways and God's thoughts are infinitely higher than our thoughts. Romans 11, 37. His judgments are unsearchable. His ways unfathomable. Again, what was shown to Job. 1 Corinthians 2, 11. Only the Spirit of God searches the deep things of God. Again, corresponding to Psalm 147, 5. 1 Timothy 6:16, we've mentioned God dwells in an unapproachable light no man has seen or can see. Divine incomprehensibility is also rooted, as I've mentioned, in the manner of God's being. I want to look at only one text briefly in connection to that, and that is 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 27. This, if you recall, is the dedication of the temple of God. Solomon is leading the people in the dedication of this building, which is arguably the most remarkable human structure any of these people had ever seen, both in terms of beauty, but also just in terms of immensity and grandeur. There is nothing in their world like the Solomonic Temple. Perhaps the pyramids in Egypt, but of course the pyramids in Egypt by this time are already ancient and in a state of disrepair. And if you've seen the pyramids in Egypt, they're pretty phenomenal, and they're impressive in their scope, and you can imagine them when they were nicely laid and smooth and all that. But I have to tell you that the beauty and the intricate ornaments on the Solomonic Temple evoke a much greater detail of artistry and wonder. All the little pomegranates and the cherubs and the trees carved into walls and the beautiful pillars and capitals. And so here is Solomon leading these people in a worship service of consecration, consecrating a house of God here on this hill, Zion. And he goes on and he says in verse 26, verse 27, there's almost this pause in his thought. He's going along, speaking about God's faithfulness and his covenant to David and all this. And then 1 Kings 8:27, Solomon sort of pauses a moment and just wonders at what they're doing. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Wait a minute. What are we doing? We're standing here on a hill with a house that we built with our hands. We're calling this house the temple of God, Bethel, the house of God. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? And then he makes a profound statement. Behold, heaven and the highest heavens cannot contain you. Or literally, the expression is, the heaven of heavens cannot contain you. How much more this house which I have built. It's something like this. And by the way, the key phrase for incomprehensibility in that verse is the word contain. Okay, so make a note of that. Here he builds a house without peer, a house like none other than anyone has ever seen, certainly an enviable dwelling, if ever there were one. And yet Solomon stops in the middle of this prayer of in the middle of this service of dedication, and sort of reminds himself, and I take it everyone else and those of us who have this record, reminds us that even in this remarkable display of God's presence, God is not captured by or contained even in the remarkable displays of his presence. See what I'm getting at? In other words, is the temple a unique place of divine manifested presence? Yes, like no other. In this place, so long as Israel continues in faithful covenant with him, the cloud and the pillar and the Shekinah shine forth, and the face of God, as it were, smiles on Israel from this location. Okay? This is a concentrated, phenomenal manifestation of remarkable presence, the likes of which cannot be found in any other place. Let us not think that these remarkable displays of divine presence somehow contain God, or that we've somehow got him there in that house on that hill. Because will God indeed dwell on the earth? In other words, is the world enough to contain him? The answer, no. It's not enough to contain him. So he says, will he indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven of heavens cannot contain you. So let's kick it up a notch. Can the heavens, let us take this to be the highest atmosphere and the space beyond it. All that stuff you see from the Hubble telescope beam back to Earth. Is God's being sort of contained? In other words, does the world get its arms around God? No. Then he goes one better, and this is in Hebrew form, this would be a description of the very throne room of God in heaven. Does the heaven of heavens, that is to say, does the highest heaven in Jewish thought, that place where God is enthroned and where he is worshipped incessantly by angels who fall down crying, holy, 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 that throne room of Isaiah 6, is God contained there? Let us say this. What is contained there is a unique and exalted manifestation of divine glory that is unlike any manifestation of divine glory perceived or ever seen anywhere else in all of creation. But this we must remember. Heaven is created. Those seraphs, that throne, that light on which they gaze, which I take it is not the light, by the way, the light on earth that corresponds to that light and that luminosity of that heavenly glory is the Shekinah glory. Can I say this? The Shekinah glory is not the unapproachable light. Neither is the heavenly manifestation of glory. Because very clearly, many creatures approach and gaze on that light. Do you see what I'm getting? I think we need to be careful. There is a difference between the unapproachable light in which God dwells and the approachable very manifestations of light in which he manifests himself. He manifests himself in Shekinah glory. It's an approachable but awe-inspiring light. That is but a candle compared to the light that fills the heavenly place. In fact, the new heavens and new earth are described as having no sun and no moon in that place, for God and the Lamb are the light in that place. The luminosity of revealed glory that emanates from the very throne room presence of God is manifold times more resplendent and glorious to gaze upon than even the Shekinah was. Okay? The point, though, is even the heaven of heavens, still, if we were to think of this as a creator-creature distinction, if we were to sort of build it something like this, let's call this the absolute distinction of being between God and the world. The triune God dwells in inapproachable light. He's the creator. Creation, time, history, even the future state, creation marked by the passage of moments down here. Creation includes even heaven itself. Heaven is not, in other words, the being of God and the manifestation of God's presence in heaven are not commensurate to each other. Can I say it like this? The glory of God is always infinitely greater than the most glorious representation or manifestation of that glory. The glory of God is always greater than the most glorious presentation of that glory. That's why when you go to Job, again, he talks about all these displays of power and the shroud of glory, and yet he says, in them God is not known. Twice Elihu says that. The point is not we're sitting there with a sort of mystical blank in our head. The point is that in our knowing, we understand that there is a beyondness in the being of God that is not captured or measured by the manifestations of God. Whether that is in the temple in Jerusalem or whether that is in the very throne room of God in heaven, heaven itself lies on the creature side of the creator-creature distinction. So that he says, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you. And then adds this, how much less this house which I have built. The medievals had this principle that the finite cannot contain the infinite. Now, if we apply that metaphysically in terms of being, finite being which depends for its existence upon another, which is sort of the baseline for finitude, being which depends upon another for its very existence, is not sufficient to, as it were, measure the one who is without boundary in glory and in being. If we can move that, like we did with the word fathom, over to the realm of knowledge, no finite act of knowing, which is all we've ever got, no finite act of knowledge is adequate to contain within it, to hold it within it, an infinite being, an infinite object of knowledge. Only an infinite act of knowing is equal to an infinite act of being. And for that reason, even in glory, we will always be finite in our knowledge, much perfected from our current state of knowledge. And to the extent that sin clouds our vision of God, that of course will be removed for us in glory. But we will not then graduate into the light which no man can approach into. Rather, that light is not contained by any manifestation of it. What we will graduate to is a remarkably higher manifestation of glory. But we will not, as it were, enter into an unaccommodated, unrevealed, because perfectly known glory of God. There will always be this beyondness in his being. Heaven of heavens cannot contain him. When we get to the heaven of heavens, we will not arrive at the place where God's glory is hemmed in. Now, containing is the idea of getting around. We have a word for this, and I'll let us go with this. We do this, we talk about, we say this sometimes when we don't understand something. We say, I can't get my mind around that. That's the idea of comprehending. Comprehending is getting your mind around a thing. Just like physically, comprehending is getting hold of a thing. I have this little clip in my pocket. I can apprehend it this way. Okay, a policeman chases down a criminal, and we say he apprehends him when he, takes him down. I can apprehend this. But I move from apprehending to comprehending when I do this. Prehendere, prehend, means to grasp. Comprehendere, when we throw that prefix on there, means to grasp in a way in which there is no outside, there is no unboundedness in the thing that you are grasping. But as we know God, even in our knowing, there is a sense of not getting around. That's not comprehending. So that the knowing is real, just as the apprehending is, and yet my apprehending is not my comprehending. Therefore, my knowing, actually coming into contact with the truth about how God is not me getting him or figuring him out, but there's this beyondness even in my grasping. All right, we'll leave it there. Pray that the Lord causes us to grow in our apprehension and not delude ourselves with the idea of comprehension. Let us pray.